Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Business people are taught to make decisions with facts and logic and to avoid emotional bias, but according to the latest research, we almost never decide rationally, despite thinking that we do. Our experiences carry an emotional charge encoded in the synapses of our neurons. And when we try to deny what our emotions tell us, we lose what we've learned from the past. That's just one of many recent discoveries that help explain why management is so challenging. As author Charles Jacobs explains in his new book, Management Rewired: Why Feedback Doesn't Work and Other Surprising Lessons from the Latest Brain Science, much of the conventional wisdom taught to managers is not only inadequate, it produces the opposite of what was intended. The better path is frequently counterintuitive. Charles S. Jacobs is managing partner of 180 Partners and an advisor to Fortune 500 companies, and was also the founder of the Amherst Consulting Group in the 1980s. Charlie, welcome to Edgewise.
Dave, thanks for having me on.
Can you just make some general comments about the activities that you see and the judgments that people are making in positions of power based on overanalysis and perhaps not trusting their gut instincts?
Sure. I don't know if you had an opportunity to see this, but John Stewart interviewed Alan Greenspan, and in his perfect, inimitable way, he said to him, "You believe in free markets. If you believe in free markets, why do we need the Fed?" And Greenspan, without missing a beat, responded, "Because human psychology drives the markets as well." So people aren't necessarily making rational decisions all the time. They're making a lot of decisions that are simply based on their feelings or their goals or their yearnings or their fears or whatever it may be. So we're not really dealing with straightforward, logical decision making. A lot of what's going on right now, people would say, well, this is just an animal response. They're just going after whatever they can get as if they had never been civilized. This is just barbaric behavior. I would suggest that it's exactly the opposite. I think that part of what's happening right now is that people are trusting logic in a way that they shouldn't necessarily be trusting it. As you mentioned in the opening, a lot of what we find is when we're making decisions, we don't tend to be logical, we tend to be emotional. However, if we don't bring our emotion into the process, if we try to keep it out, which is the standard way of thinking in the business world, something very funny happens. We lose the ability to access what we've learned in the past. So our past experiences are not going to help us look forward to the future. We lose the ability to have forethought. So what we end up doing is being very, very narrow-minded in our thinking. We think perhaps about a bonus, and we don't think about the fallout as a result of the bonus. We think about running a company to maximize profit in the short term, and we don't think about going after long-term profit.
Exactly. That's interesting. Now, there's a lot of talk in the news right now about salary caps and big bonuses. What does brain science tell us about the effectiveness of financial incentives?
It's interesting. The overriding message that's coming out of the brain science right now is things are only what we think they are. We walk around with this illusion in our culture that we actually have direct contact with the physical world and our knowledge of it is objective. We all see the same thing. We're all responding to the same kind of experience. Well, what we really find is when we perceive something, when our senses are keyed, the message goes up into our brain. It's disaggregated. It's pulled apart. It's then put back together and it's compared to memory, so that we can recognize it as something that's familiar. At the same time, though, the areas of the brain that are responsible for our feelings, for our beliefs, for our yearnings, all of those are firing as well. And what this means is we're putting things back together, not in terms of what they are out in the world, but in terms of what we think they are.
So could you expand on that, please?
Sure. If we take that and we apply that to salaries, what we find is salaries really are a function not of their absolute level, but what we think of them. So, for instance, we find a salary increase given by our boss that's 5% may be highly motivational from his perspective or her perspective, but not to us. In the same way, a salary increase or absolute salary is going to be compared to our peers and will determine if it's motivational based on that. There's no kind of absoluteness here. But the reality of it is the salary ultimately isn't a motivator. Now, I'm not being Pollyannish about this, suggesting that we'd all show up for work if we weren't getting paid. But what we find is when the pleasure center of the brain, the nucleus accumbens, releases the neurotransmitter called dopamine, we get these great feelings of pleasure. That's not a result of us targeting a reward. It's a result of us focusing on the work itself. So the more that we hold out rewards, regardless of their size, to people, the more we move people away from that place where they're really engaged in the work, really happy, and really productive.
Right. The reward, ironically, becomes a distraction from the work.
It does the opposite of what we expect it to do. That's really the point of the book, that so much of what we're doing in management that we've taken for granted, brain science has taught us, produces the opposite of what we think it should be doing. This isn't anything, by the way, that's brand new. It's just that brain science is giving us a lot of hard data to substantiate this.
Do you have any advice for managers right now who are being put in the position of not only laying off workers, but also keeping the survivors motivated?
This is always a hard one, and it's not the people that you're laying off that you really need to be worried about from the perspective of the business. Clearly, that's a terrible thing to happen to somebody, but it's the people that remain, because now they're no longer focused on the work, they're insecure, they're worried about what's going to happen. The most brilliant manager that I ever saw in tough times was actually one that was a peer of mine in an organization. And we were going through lots of change. There was a downturn in the economy. People were getting laid off. And all of my people were wondering, what should we do? And they were worried about their jobs. He had his people really focused on the work as if nothing else was going on. And it was interesting. He ran international marketing. People couldn't travel because there were restrictions on that. Nevertheless, they were busy from the moment they came in to the moment they left. And because of that, they didn't get distracted, and they didn't get worried, and they didn't feel insecure.
Charlie, it strikes me that everybody sort of carries around this database of symbols and archetypes and images in their head, and they use that to break things apart and reference their impact to themselves. Talk about the power of stories and metaphors and symbols.
I think they're enormously powerful, and I think in our very rational age, we tend to discount them. Stories are the way, and this is not just my point of view, this is what most scientists believe. Stories are the way the mind naturally makes sense of the world. While we may think that we are logical, every study that's ever been done says that we're not logical. And in fact, if you look at children before they acquire formal thinking, they're explaining the world in terms of stories. You look at ancient civilizations, they too are explaining the world in terms of stories. Why are stories so effective? If we go back to this notion that we're not thinking rationally, that instead our emotions are always coming into play, well, stories address both the intellect and the emotion. So do metaphors, by the way. And I think of metaphors as just moving picture stories taking place over time. Because they're operating on a greater part of the brain, they're more impactful for us. Because they're the way that we make sense out of the world naturally, we immediately take them as our own. We identify with them. If you think about reading a novel or going to a movie or watching a television program, the pleasure you get is because you've identified with a character, and so you've worked through a lot of what the character is working through. So it's almost as if, rather than giving you a formal argument why you should do something, if I tell you a story, you identify with the story and you actually rehearse what it's like to operate in that way. And so it's much more powerful. It's much more effective. The other thing, every so often I'll have a slight disagreement with my spouse.
That never happens to me.
And I will use my best logic to put forward an argument why I'm right. When my wife hears this, she immediately says, oh, honey, of course you're right. I was wrong. That doesn't happen at all. She takes the same facts, the same logic. She turns around to support her point of view. Well, that's what happens with logic. We tend to just come back at it logically.
Right.
A story people don't have to defend themselves against because we're not asking them to take it as true. We're asking them simply to entertain it. So it's far more effective for people.
Right. It wasn't too long ago, before the advent of personal computers, that people worshipped at the altar of the mainframe, and the people and the programmers who serviced the mainframe wore lab coats, and they were almost high priests. Now we've got laptops and portable computers and Blackberries and cell phones and whatnot. Can you talk for a second about the impact of technology on being more or less human?
Let's talk about mirror neurons for a minute. These were discovered not too long ago in monkeys. This is a fairly recent discovery, and it was sort of an accident. They were trying to measure activity in the premotor cortex, which controls motion. And as they watched monkeys engaged in activity, they saw activity in the premotor cortex. They also were monitoring monkeys that were watching other monkeys engaged in the activity, and they saw exactly the same activity. In other words, mirror neurons fire whether we're engaged in doing something or we're actually doing it. Now, they've been discovered in human beings, but there's a little twist. We also mirror the intent. So the prefrontal cortex, the big brain part that thinks logically, is mirroring the intent of somebody who is engaged in an activity or an action. When you are not face to face with a person, those mirror neurons don't fire in the same way, because we need to pick up physical clues in order to get them firing. As I'm sitting looking at you now, I'm constantly reading your eyes and your lips, and that tells me about your mental state and starts my mirror neurons firing. If I'm talking to you over the phone, if I'm on a computer with you, that's not happening. So I'm losing a big part of my ability to identify with you.
You have to guess on certain things.
Right. And so you're not getting the full message, and it doesn't have the same impact. And of course, a lot of the emotion that's so important to our decision making gets stripped out as well. On the phone, you have tone of voice. We can do some things in email, but we're really narrowing it down. On the other hand, I have a laptop. It's the greatest thing in the world that's ever happened to me. The internet allows me to access all kinds of information. But part of what happens is now we have a lot of information. We don't necessarily have the ability to process all of it consciously and make decisions. In fact, we find that we can process maybe about 7 things at any one time. And then it overloads our conscious mind, whereas our emotional brain can process a myriad of things and not get overloaded. So as we're cutting that out, we're really narrowing our ability to think. The bottom line is we need to learn how to use technology in a smart way.
To assist us.
Yeah.
Rather than act as a filter.
Great point.
Charlie, some people who are listening to this program will probably say, okay, this is interesting, but it strikes me as something I saw on the Discovery Channel a couple of years ago. What's new about this? Why should we care about it now?
Well, what's new about this is that brain science is really turning business on its head. Not only is it focusing us on how the mind works and teaching us that we have to build that into the way that we conduct our business, but it's taking a lot of the things that we've taken for granted and turning them totally upside down. So many of the standard management practices that we take for granted now are being proved to be ineffective. You always learn as a manager that you need to give feedback to your people in order for them to improve their performance. This actually goes back a long time to a study at General Electric. What we find is positive feedback has no effect one way or the other. Negative feedback, if it has any effect, tends to decrease performance rather than improve it. And part of this has to do with the fact that we're making sense of the world in our head, like we talked about before. So when we see feedback that conflicts with our image of ourselves, you know what we do? We just discount it or rationalize it away. Defective customer, defective boss, whatever it may be. We find the same thing is the case when it comes to, for instance, focusing on objectives. Yes, it's important for us to have measures of our business, but if we only focus on a numerical objective, we lose access to that emotional knowledge. We then begin to become very short-term in our thinking. I think of the book that I wrote, Management Rewired, very much as if it's the operating manual for the managerial mind.
User's manual.
Yeah. We're never taught how to use the brain, but now we're beginning to find out certain things, like when we're in a situation. Let our minds work on it for a little while. When we're trying to manage people, we're not going to discourage them from pursuing self-interest. People are driven by genetic selfishness. That's why we have survived. So why even try? Why instead don't we begin to leverage that self-interest? Why don't we manage in a way where we let people do what they want to do, but we reward the behavior that advances the goals of the enterprise? Why don't we begin to structure organizations in a way so that we give people maximum freedom? But again, we reward what contributes to the enterprise. What this really does is suggest that we need to kind of open things up a bit. And the model that I come back to is the model that we had at the beginning of our country, which is entrepreneurship. We create businesses that are really comprised of different entrepreneurs relating to one another through market mechanisms, and people are going to be more energized, more focused. We're going to waste less energy on control systems that aren't effective in any way. And that's what I really think the revolution is all about.
Revolution describes it very well. Many people tend to be a little bit old school when it comes to things like this. They'll look at incremental change and ways of fine-tuning, but they would find something as whole-scale as you're proposing, rethinking the social structure of a business or something like that, extremely anxiety-inducing, and I'm not sure they would see the practicality of it. Are there steps that people can take to move in that direction without shaking the entire structure of an organization?
Absolutely. I'm very aware of the fact that probably the biggest problem in any business is change. And the more established the business is, the more successful it's been in the past, the harder it is for it to change. I think that there are incremental movements you can make that are going to get you a great return on the investment. When I work with clients, what I get them to do is start out focusing on what's this business all about? What do we need to do to be successful? What's our vision? And our vision's got to go beyond simply objectives, because again, they're going to narrow our decision-making. Instead, what are we doing that's going to really get people turned on? What's the competitive strategy that we need to be successful? Once they have that in place, then say, what kind of organization do we need to put in place to get that competitive strategy implemented? Well, you can see how efficient this whole process is. There's no wasted motion. We're not using something that doesn't contribute to our focus on our goals. But at the same time, there are going to be constraints. I used to do a lot of work in the steel industry, and you won't find a more conservative industry. At one point, I was hired by a steel company to redesign one of their mills. They wanted to do this in a weekend. I convinced them to give me a team of supervisors pulled from the organization to work through this process. It took us about 6 weeks of working through it. What we did was take an organization that had 480 managers and reduce it to 18 leaders. We got out of this big old building they had with six floors. We went into a big metal building that just sat in the middle of the mill. There were no offices. Everything was a team decision. There was no direct supervision. We saved on revenues of $800 million the first year, $85 million in expenses. Everybody thought, well, what's going to happen? You pull away supervision, people won't do the right thing. You know what happens? People do the right thing. And you can build in safeguards. This isn't giving the keys to the asylum to the inmates. As you begin to move to things that we know now and that we've really actually felt for a long time are the right thing to do, the results are absolutely stunning. And that's what we need today, those kinds of results. We can't cut our expenses any further. We need to really rethink the business and take what's going on in the economy right now as an opportunity. Because people are willing to change now. They recognize how serious the situation is. We can drive change that we couldn't drive at any point before. It's like Rahm Emanuel's line, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. This is a crisis. We can really use it to our advantage.
Now's the time. We've been speaking to Charlie Jacobs, author of the new book, Management Rewired, Why Feedback Doesn't Work, and Other Surprising Lessons from the Latest Brain Science. Charlie, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Just remember, we really need your feedback. So please drop us an email at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That number again is 800-697-3406. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.